on camera, and then I'm going to go ahead and end the poll. But before I do that, I'm going to also talk a little bit about those responses. So, Amy, it looks like we have another strong showing from the Northeast U.S. again, but we've got a lot of attendees coming from Central U.S., Southeast U.S., all over the place. And we even have a European viewer on today. So thank you. Thank you for joining us. In terms of the profession, it looks like overwhelmingly we're being joined today, almost half the audience is identifying as state, local, or tribal governments, but we do have a number of economic development professionals, environmental consultants, federal attendees, planners, and then people who have identified as other. So I want to thank everybody for providing that background information. I'm going to stop sharing these polls, and then I'll turn it over to you, Amy, to begin the session today.
Thank you, Jean. Thanks so much. Great instructions, great webinar, great polls. Hi, everyone. I'm so happy that you're here. Welcome to Friday. We have a big crowd. Thank you so much for joining. This is, as Jean mentioned, the third webinar in our series for EPA's Redevelopment Academy. And it's been going really great. We're so glad for all the participation and for all the feedback that we've been getting so far. EPA, Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, we've been hosting these webinars because we really want to support community-led efforts to reuse contaminated properties, formerly contaminated properties. And we know that's hard. And so we want to keep having an ongoing dialogue with all of you and share information as we get it about places where it has been done and do a deep dive as much as we can in a webinar as to how these projects really came to be. So I won't take too long just to say, though, that we have partnered with Vita Nova, who's a national consultancy. They specialize in site repositioning, particularly sites where there's been difficult to redevelop. And so we've worked with them on all sorts of different types of projects, different technical assistance activities over the years to help communities get ready for reuse. And so they are the team that has pulled together these examples for today. So Abe, can you go ahead and flip to the next slide? So just really quickly, you see our agenda here. We've got four success stories to talk about today. We'll get into how that's been done in the next slide. Just wanted to cover, briefly what our objectives are today to not only talk about these stories, but really talk about how these organizations dealt with environmental risk and the liabilities that were present in their projects and what it took to attract development and investment to the sites. So I'm going to stop there, turn it over to Michael Taylor from Vita Nova. Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks, everybody. This is the culmination of what has been a great webinar series. But as you guys know, until the shovel gets in the ground, rubber meets the road, until something gets built, gets redeveloped, it's all theory, right? So, Abe, if you can go to the next slide. So Elaine Richardson, my partner, and I will be supporting this. Elaine's going to give a little bit of a summary of the first two webinars just to set up the speakers today. As you recall, Elaine spoke on the first webinar. But I really just want to take a second and talk a little bit about these three projects, which we really believe gives the breadth of opportunities for communities to rebuild, right? So the first one, developer responding to an RFP, came in, did a lot of things. He's going to talk about it. I'm not going to give it away. Second, an entity tied to the city of Buffalo, Buffalo Urban Development Corporation, took a very large industrial facility and repurposed it. And then finally, and we think this is somewhat groundbreaking, Toledo Community Foundation worked with the Port Authority to actually make solar return community benefits in the form of cash to the area next to the Jeep site, an area we worked in for many years, lots of abandonment, lots of crime, tough on its heels, and they're helping to rebuild it. So a lot of community benefit in all of these projects. We're very excited to have that hat, to share that with you. And then the last thing I'll say is we are going to show the math today. So, you know, if you've ever talked to a developer, he never wants to tell you the secret sauce. He never wants to tell you how he makes the math work. But these guys are going to lay it out for you. And I think there's going to be a lot for everyone to learn. The webinars will be recorded. I'm sure that our speakers would be happy to take questions afterward. But without further ado, I'll turn it over to Elaine, and we're going to get this show on the road. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Next slide, please. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, today we're going to talk a little bit about the introduction to not only real estate development, but in particular brownfields redevelopment. And for those who have been on the previous presentations and webinars, this will be a little bit of a refresher for some of the things and topics we talked about previously. Next slide. So Revitalization Ready is a new guide that EPA is putting together and will be releasing that will help communities walk through the steps of brownfields redevelopment. So today we're going to focus on first the reuse assessment process, developing a reuse plan, and a reuse implementation strategy. And those are the three topics I will review over the next 10 minutes. But then our presenters will come on and really talk you through the reuse implementation process and how they actually brought all of these steps to a reality. Next slide. So the first step in really evaluating a property is the reuse assessment process. And the significant portion of this is due diligence. And that's a term that we hear quite commonly related to real estate development. But there's actually two types of due diligence. The first being environmental due diligence, which is critically important for property owners and communities prior to acquiring or taking ownership in a property in order to meet the requirements for all appropriate inquiries. And that's something that is typically known and thought about in the environmental and brownfields industry. But in addition, there's the real estate due diligence process, which is really understanding what the opportunities are associated with that property. What's the infrastructure? What's the accessibility, the zoning, and other characteristics that can make it attractive to a developer or constrain reuse of that property? Both of these are critically important, and we'll go into a little bit of detail about some of those constraints. Next slide. So there are a couple of constraints on redevelopment that we want you to think about. First are the constraints that present a risk to the deal. And environmental is one of those. It can be so complicated that actually getting redevelopment done can be a very difficult process. But what we learned in earlier webinars is that those aren't the only constraints to a deal that you need to be aware of. Some of the others that we commonly look at in projects and run into are constraints due to unclear deeds, unclear titles, easements that are not fully documented, inaccurate surveys, information about the property from a legal standpoint that would be important for communities and for property owners to identify prior to redevelopment. Because if you can address some of those constraints early on, you can make it more attractive to the marketplace. But then there's also constraints that limit market opportunities. And those are some of the things that I just mentioned a minute ago. Access. Are the roads that serve the property sufficient? Are the utilities there? Is there sewage and water? What other infrastructure needs to be put there? And are those constraints or are those limiting factors too costly to make the property attractive to the market? And removing those constraints, such as making infrastructure investments in advance of redevelopment, are things that communities can do ahead of time, or at least can identify ahead of time, that can help attract developers and make the actual project to be a profitable one. Next slide, please. So as part of the reuse assessment, we need to identify the risks and liabilities associated with a property. In the event that a community is going to take ownership, whether it be through condemnation, tax foreclosure, or eminent domain, the community will take on some of these risks. So it's important to understand the types of risks that you need to be aware of. The first is fairly obvious when we're talking about brownfields, and that's environmental liability. If there's no responsible party there, you're taking on the environmental liability for soil and groundwater. But that's not all. If there are buildings on the property, you're also taking on liability for asbestos, lead-based paint, maybe PCBs that might be some of the building materials. So there are a number of things that you need to be aware of and be sure to identify prior to taking ownership, and then certainly prior to redeveloping. There's financial liability. Oftentimes when communities take on a property, they do have to at least acknowledge the costs associated with soil and groundwater remedial action. There may be buildings that need to be demolished and asbestos to be removed. And often those costs cannot be covered necessarily in the grants that EPA can provide, but you may need to find other funding sources for some of these situations. And there's also market risk. Just because you have a vision for this property doesn't mean the market demand is there. So communities may end up holding on to a property longer than they anticipated, and that comes with costs. And finally, there are the risks associated with community issues, ongoing safety and health hazards that might exist until the property is cleaned up, and also whether or not the community will support the redevelopment plans that are market viable. So not all community uses or community visions are something that the market can handle. And so there can be a gap between what the community wants and what the market actually will support. And that often can raise other risks associated with getting the project and property complete. Next slide, please. How you approach the risks and liabilities must be considered during your reuse planning process. So now we're getting into the planning step of this. Managing those risks are all about understanding them, controlling them, and when possible, transferring them in the development process. So understanding and quantifying risk, that's obviously related much to your environmental liabilities. It has to do with the soil and groundwater, that contamination that may be associated with the property, but it's also, as we said, what are some of the building hazards that you may need to be aware of? And are there any other risks associated with the property itself? From a control perspective, understanding how the property can be managed and how some of those liabilities may be able to be managed from a regulatory standpoint. Can those liabilities be transferred onto a new property owner? Can they be further protected by liability insurance, transactional insurance? All of that is part of this planning process, because to successfully transfer and redevelop a property requires answering all of these concerns. So again, from an environmental liability, maybe the reuse planning process will identify integrating the remedy with the development in order to reduce the costs of remediation, and at the same time, prepare the property for redevelopment. From a financial liability standpoint, you may be able to transfer, as I said, some of that liability onto a new owner, and they may actually be able to make money in the redevelopment process while they're doing the environmental aspects of it. And finally, whatever you can do to help manage and help a future developer manage the risks of community support can go a long way to making the entitlement and approval process for the developer much easier, which limits the risk on the developer. All of these things should be considered throughout the reuse planning process. Next slide, please. Also, during the reuse planning stage, it's important to understand the economics of the property and the project, and understanding it from the developer or investor's point of view. So developers are in the business to make money. That's not a bad thing. It's good for them to make money. They can then go on and invest in other areas. So from that perspective, they want to make sure that they can turn a profit for any type of development. So by doing a financial pro forma ahead of time, you will understand whether there are gaps from in the feasibility of a redevelopment process and be able to identify ways to mitigate those gaps in development. It's not unusual for brownfields to be upside down, to where often the money that you can make from a redevelopment does not cover all the environmental costs, especially if there are significant infrastructure improvements required. And so to the extent that you can know this ahead of time and be able to present solutions to a developer, the more successful you will be in attracting developers to your site. Next slide, please. A disposition strategy, which is part of what a community should put together to identify how are you going to attract developers, how are you going to disposition or transfer this property onto somebody else. It is a critical part of your planning and strategic process. This process should identify the financial gaps that the pro forma showed and identify solution to those gaps. So not only are EPA funds available, and that's part of the purpose of EPA putting on all these webinars, is to understand what they can do for you, but there are also other types of grants and funding opportunities. So state brownfields matching grants, HUD grants, the new infrastructure dollars that may become available are all things that you should be thinking about to try and make these properties more attractive and to overcome those constraints that you identified in the reuse assessment process. Next slide, please. In attracting developers to your project, you have to understand that in different markets, developers have different expectations and they also have different ability to make money. So in first tier markets, such as New York City, Seattle, Los Angeles, some of our bigger cities, these are very active real estate markets. And even though there may be some constraints related to environmental or even some infrastructure, most of the time the market demand is sufficient to support the cleanup that is required in those locations. There's also a lot of money out there for the communities and for the cities to do some of their own developments. And so from that perspective, less often are you looking for the big dollar investments from other sources. But once you get to second tier markets, such as Buffalo, Cleveland, and Indianapolis, you will need public-private partnerships to successfully redevelop a project. The markets do not have that much demand and that much leeway in their profitability for real estate to be able to take on significant infrastructure or environmental contamination costs. And furthermore, when you get down to even smaller markets, such as Gary, Indiana, or Pocatillo, Idaho, or Meriden, Connecticut, which we're going to hear about today, you really need to have the support of significant both governmental and nonprofit dollars and partnerships in order to make these things a reality. Next slide, please. So what can communities do? Some of the things that they're able to do here is to make information publicly available out there, make sure that the information that is there, websites, state websites, all of the information is accurate. Time and time again, we see information out there that is inaccurate and doesn't have up-to-date information. And most of the developers that are looking at sites are starting with an online database search. And so if they're seeing information and making decisions on that information, you want to make sure that it is accurate. Make sure it's easy to find. Have a website, have tools that can help promote those sites that are available. And finally, create an investment package. An investment package is an important tool that communities can use to promote a particular property and all that it has to offer. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, an investment package is a guide that identifies the strengths and priorities. It's putting all of that information about your city, your community, and the property itself and neighborhood where it's located, all in one location, easy to read, easy to use, and helps bring the community vision to a developer. By putting all of this information in one complete package, you can then distribute that out to the market, whether it's through an expression of interest process, whether it's online, whether it's to a select group of developers that might be of interest, or even going so far as cold calling. But it's a tool that your community and your ambassadors and community in your community, which might be your real estate community, your nonprofits, other business people, the Chamber of Commerce, can help promote that because they have a packet of accurate information. And it's something that EPA has guides for how to do investment packages that can also help support the work that you're doing. Next slide, please. So that was a really quick overview of some of the things and topics that we talked about in webinar 1 and 2. If you didn't participate in those webinars, I'd encourage you to go back and watch the videos from those. It'll give you a little bit more detail on some of these topics that I just talked about. But really what we want to get down to today is talking about how you really do this implementation. And today we're going to hear from three different communities, three different speakers talking about four different projects in four different communities, and learn about the different approaches that were used. Some of them, as Mike Taylor said, very groundbreaking ideas on how to bring funding and encourage redevelopment in their area. So without further ado, I am going to introduce Charlie from Penrose and ask him to come on screen and talk about Meriden Commons and Torrington Riverfront. Charlie?
Great. Thank you very much, Elaine. So thank you all for having me and Penrose here. I want to say, first of all, thank you to EPA and Vida Nueva for hosting this. I see a lot of attendees here, so it's really great to see a big crowd. I'm going to talk to you today mostly about Meriden Commons, and then we're going to also talk about Torrington Riverfront, which are two transactions that we've done here at Penrose. So if I could ask for the next slide, please. Great. So a little bit about who I am. I've been doing this for longer than I want to admit, almost 25 years. I've been in the Boston, Massachusetts area. I started off working for a housing authority where I did development, and then I did some work on the tax credit investment side, and then I came back over to development. And I've been now here at Penrose. This is my sixth year here. We opened up the office here in Boston to oversee the New England region, which is basically Connecticut on up. Next slide, please. Great. So a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. As I mentioned, we're going to start with Meriden Commons. I'm going to start a little bit with about sort of who Penrose is, a little bit more detail. If I get the next slide, please. Great. So we are basically an owner, manager, developer of multifamily properties. So we focus on rental properties. We'll do home ownership if it's a part of a multifamily transaction. We'll also do commercial if it's a part of a multifamily transaction. We're not experts in those, but we certainly see we certainly take those on, and we'll do do that kind of work, whether it's ground floor retail in a four-story building in Meriden, which you'll see, or as we're doing in Hartford, we're renovating a 40-unit acre site. We're taking the back 30 acres to do about 420 units. And the front 10 acres will be about 80,000 square feet of commercial, which we're partnering with another developer to do that. But we'll take on that that kind of an opportunity. Next slide. Thank you. So so a little bit more about who we are. We're about, actually we're coming on our 50 years in operation. Right now we're in 22 states and territories, as well as the District of Columbia. As I mentioned before, my territory is basically Connecticut on up, all of New England. What I provide on the slide is sort of four different examples of different types of things that we do. So you can see anywhere from the townhomes that we're doing out in Hartford at the Village of Park River, the former Westbrook Village site, to a sort of a scattered site development in Wareham. That's more of a suburban model with you know, small five-unit buildings scattered around a town green. To Torrington, which is down in the left-hand corner, which is very similar to Meriden, a four-story urban deal. And then, of course, historic renovation of assets. We do a fair amount of that. The one you see in the bottom right-hand corner there is actually a very exciting project. We're hoping to close in January, which will be the first LGBTQ-friendly deal in all of New England, and we're pretty proud of that. So I like to say we could bring any of these types of proctologies to a neighborhood just like yours, if you're interested. Next slide, please. So let's get into Meriden Commons, which is the main focus of this development. And this is, you know, really an absolutely incredible story. The city of Meriden has done tremendous work, which you'll see over the next couple of slides, in preparing their entire community for identifying various places where they could do investment. They've really done a tremendous effort of investing in their own community and done a great job of leveraging state and federal resources to try to accomplish their goals. So where do we fit into all of this? We were certainly the beneficiaries of a lot of that work that was put before us. And we also see ourselves as continuing as a catalyst for further change and transformation of the area, and in particular of the work we're doing on Meriden Commons. So Meriden Commons is actually, two phases. It's 151 units total. We have mid-rise buildings and then some townhomes. The typology here is it's 80% affordable and 20% market rate. And later on, I'll tell you about, we're trying to do the reverse across the street with the city. We have 7,000 square feet of ground floor retail. We're really excited, as you can look at this picture right here at the bottom, the glass at the very bottom of the screen. We have a deli that's in there, which is really an exciting addition to this downtown area. It's gotten a lot of good traction. It's a great place for people to come. It was something that was lacking in this area, and we're really proud of that. And part of that is that we really see that not as a place where we can actually make money, but really see it as a community benefit. And we structure the transaction in a way that we're not seeking to get profit out of that area, but really to have it basically break even and be able to serve the community. Next slide, please. So a little bit about how all we got here. For those of you that are familiar with Meriden, you will know this slide. This is what they've been working on for a long time. The area, the large area just on the left in the orange is what they used to call the hub. It was an old shopping area that had gone into foreclosure. Essentially, this area was a constant flood. So as you can sort of, you can kind of make out, there's a blue line that runs through there. Literally a river ran through that site. And so this was the main focus of the city of Meriden. But it was a part of an overall comprehensive plan, which you'll see, about taking some vacant land, some dilapidated housing downtown, and dealing with their flood issues in a really comprehensive way. So what you see just to the right in the purple, there's a top parcel that was owned by the city acquired that. Below the bottom is the old Mills Memorial, which was 140 units of public housing, very dilapidated, outdated, definitely in need of essentially demolition and rebuilding. And that was part of the overall plan. And then the parcel up to the right-hand side was a parcel that was owned by the city. So essentially there was a land swap that the city did with the housing authority to swap the land where the Mills Memorial is into the orange area to the right. And then this is where we built Meriden Commons phases one and two with 151 units. And we'll see that on the next slide, please. So ultimately, this is where it will all end up when everything is completed for the most part, with a slight change, and I'll get into that. But essentially, what you see here now is, the hub has been created, turned into Meriden Green, and that whole area is the beneficiary of about $14 million worth of funding from the state to turn that area into basically a flood management control area. So they daylighted the stream, which we saw on the other slide, and they created an absolutely beautiful park with a bridge, and it's just a gem in the city of Meriden, and it's gotten a lot of attention throughout the state. Over to the right is to the far right is Meriden Commons 1 and 2, which I mentioned. Not to go too far into the weeds here, but something that's really exciting is phase 2 is actually the first affordable passive house development in all of Connecticut, and we were very excited to be able to do that for that site. Down at the bottom of the slide is going to be our next venture. So as I mentioned before, the deal we did on the right Meriden Commons was with the Meriden Housing Authority and the city with the land swap. And the parcel on the at the bottom of the screen is with the city of Meriden, where they have retained us to do market rate housing because there's a need for market rate housing as well. Our initial proposal was to do the building you see at the bottom of the screen and then in the top right corner of where the park is. We've done some revisions with the plans. The city is loves this park so much, they've asked us to scale back the plans and just do the bottom market rate building at the bottom and leave the top building open. So, which is perfectly fine with us, and we'll continue to redevelop the city there in a way that really adds some boots on the street, on the ground for this downtown area. Next slide, please. So this is the this is where it all ended up. Well, for the most part, this is absolutely gorgeous. This is the park that they daylighted, the flood control management plan that they did. That's our building straight ahead, Meriden Phase One. When I say almost, you see a couple of dark red brick buildings to the right. That was part of the old Mills Memorial, which were demolished as part of this overall comprehensive plan to redevelop the downtown area. Those buildings are now gone completely. And all the folks that live there have been successfully relocated with Section 8 vouchers. And then they all had various rights of return to various different developments throughout Meriden that the Meriden Housing Authority and the city were redeveloping as a part of the overall comprehensive redevelopment of the site, of the entire community, I should say. Next slide. So a little bit about sort of mid-progress, where we were at the time, just to give you a sense of how many different things were happening all at once. Thought this was really helpful. So as I mentioned, it was a very complicated land swap between the city and the Housing Authority, with us being a partner with the Housing Authority on the development of Meriden Commons as a development partner. We were able to design it in such a way that we could build independent of when the demolition occurred, which is sort of important, so as not to overly complicate the timelines for each of the different pieces. We were able to complete phase one with the old Mills Memorial still in place. And as you can sort of see from this slide, we started building phase two as the city was actually completing the demolition of the Mills Memorial. So a lot of things were able to happen at the same time. Next slide, please. So, a little bit more about showing you sort of where it was and where it ended up. As you can see from here, the Mills Memorial was on the site. It really was sort of a super block, as a lot of these public housing sites tended to be back in the day, and they're just had outserved its useful purpose. And so we're really excited to basically replace those housing with units here, as well as the Housing Authority of the city, as I mentioned earlier, had placed other housing in other locations. Next slide. So I want to talk a little bit about the city of Meriden and how they got here. This will sort of dovetail into the environmental issues that that are the focus of this. So one of the things that the city of Meriden did was really sort of set them apart was really a comprehensive long-term evaluation of all of their properties. And this happened over a really long period of time. As you can see, they actually evaluated over 54 acres of various brownfields in downtown Meriden. And so they went through a process where they identified all these various sites, figured out sort of what the highest and best use was from a planning perspective, and set about a course of action where they were able to gather a tremendous number of resources to remediate much of these sites and to then solicit RFPs for developers to redevelop them. So as part of this overall comprehensive redevelopment, the Housing Authority actually was part of this as well. They put out the RFP, which we responded to and were accepted to do the Meriden Commons. The city actually put out three RFPs at the same time, one of which was the one that we won and responded to, which is about building on the green, and then two other RFPs to really revitalize their downtown area. Next slide, please. So just a little bit more about Meriden. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of distress that they're really working to overcome, and they're doing a great job of transforming their city. A lot of abandoned brownfields, a lot of the distressed public housing, which is now gone, and a lot of flooding as emblematic of the downtown main flood control area. And then there's some other areas in the city which they're currently working on doing flood control management as well. And so there was a lot of investment that was sort of needed to try to work to bring the city of Meriden back. Next slide. This gives you a little window into the sense of how much the city really got involved in trying to understand their sites. So it's over 10 years of planning and assessing sites. I included this slide here just to show you all the various properties that they did a real evaluation of. They cataloged them. They went through a process where they classified them about whether what remediation was needed, whether it was completed, whether it was in phase one, so that they really did a really comprehensive effort to really analyze all of their various parcels. Because as you've heard Elaine say, and you guys have learned throughout, obviously, the issue is these sites can't be developed unless they're clean. And usually that takes additional resources and a real municipal input to try to get these sites what we call shovel ready or ready for developers like us to come in and be able to develop on these sites. Next slide. So a little bit more detail about their approach, and I think this sort of highlights some of the key elements here. I won't go through all of them, but just you can read it on the screen. But really, it's all about starting with a planning effort to determine what their goals are. It really takes a village where you can see all the various groups that they brought in to help do this planning. They really then went through a site evaluation to determine what kinds of sites they have. Part of their overall plan, though, also was to revise their zoning. So the Meriden Commons that we did is actually a TOD development. I didn't get a chance to mention that, but at the same time, all of this other stuff was happening. The train station was being renovated and improved, and new lines were being added to bring people back and forth to Hartford. So this is actually a TOD site. So they actually revised their zoning to be respectful and consistent with what a TOD development would be like. So that really allowed us to increase the density there, which otherwise we wouldn't have been able to do. As I mentioned before, they did a lot of due diligence. They assessed the various risks to their properties. And then they figured out, what was the right strategy in terms of remediation or abatement, and where were they going to get those resources. Next slide. And all of this really was to lead to the final outcome here, which is in the red box, which was to, as I mentioned earlier, was to get these sites shovel ready and ready for developers like us to come in. And we're not the only developer that's in Meriden. There are three or four of us that were all part of this overall comprehensive plan to redevelop the city. And so the hard work of the city to actually pull these resources in to get these sites cleaned up allowed us and other developers to try to execute their vision for what they wanted to see for a redeveloped housing in their downtown area. Next slide, please. So getting a little bit more as we sort of zero in a little bit more on the nitty gritty, I mentioned a land swap. So I wanted to sort of highlight that a little bit. As you can see here, there are actually sort of four addresses connected to Meriden Commons. the Mills Memorial in the blue, that was the Meriden Housing Authority owned site where the existing public housing was. And then the other parcels, 161, 177, and 62 Cedar, were either already owned by the city or were acquired by the city for this overall comprehensive redevelopment plan. And so what happened at the end of the day is the Cedar Park in green was land swapped with the blue between the Housing Authority and the city. The Meriden, where the Meriden Mills is in blue, is now part of an extension of the Meriden on the Green flood control management project. And the city is out there acquiring dollars to extend the green to that area. And obviously we then, after the land swapped, we partnered with the Meriden Housing Authority to develop Meriden Commons 1 and 2 on 161 State Street, 177th Street, and 62 Cedar Street. This slide also gives you a little sense of the resources that were involved in trying to make that happen. So just for these sites alone, you can see the monies from DECD, which we were very appreciative of, to renovate these sites, as well as to demo Meriden Mills on the the Mills Memorial. So you can see here, it adds up to not quite $3 million, but pretty close when you add up the various funds that were invested in that. That's on top of the $14 million that's down below that the city procured to redo the Meriden Green and create the flood management control project there. Next slide, please. So as was mentioned earlier by Michael, yes, we are sharing some numbers. And so whenever you do mixed income, affordable housing, it can be very challenging to find the resources because the resources are always very scarce. This gives you a general sense of how the deal was structured. One of the things that that sort of jumps out for phase one is the high acquisition cost. One of the additional factors on Meriden Commons one was the fact that Mills Memorial was encumbered by a energy performance grant. And so in order for us to move forward to tear that down and build Meriden Commons phase one, we had to pay that off. So fortunately, we were able to get some additional federal home loan money at the time to be able to get some additional resources to the project to allow us to pay off that debt. And it sort of got structured as basically an acquisition. The other sources here that you see were very indebted to the Connecticut Housing Finance Agency. As you can see, they provided the large bulk of funds available for this transaction, $16 million. That comes from tax credits that we were able to generate and then sell to an investor. The permanent loan is basically conventional financing that we put on the deal based on the rents and expenses. We were also a beneficiary of what we call a Federal Home Loan Bank subsidized advance, which allowed us, they provided an interest rate subsidy to allow us to write down the interest on the loan to allow us to raise more proceeds. So that's a higher loan than you would typically see on a transaction of this nature. And then of course, very indebted to the Department of Housing for their FLEC funds, which is essentially a long-term 0% interest loan on the deal. And then we also got a Federal Home Loan Bank grant to tie it out to complete it. That was for phase one. Phase two, very similar structure. I won't go through all of it, but essentially the same structure with the absence of the acquisition loan. And phase two, the costs were higher on construction because it was past steps. Next slide, please. So I wanted to include Torrington Riverfront, which is the deal which is currently in construction on now in the city of Torrington. Another similar story of a site that needed to be remediated, and the municipality took that responsibility on and remediated it for us so that we could come in and develop it. And one of the things I think is particularly important here is that if there are any folks out there that are really interested, you know, from a municipality that are really interested in trying to do this and might have been overwhelmed by the 10 years experience that that the city of Meriden spent in pulling all this together, this is a great example of where something can be done in a much more quicker and expedited way to really get things going. And we'll get into that. Next slide, please. So we were very fortunate working with the city of Torrington. They had acquired this 2-acre parcel here and had done some initial cleanup. They knew they needed to do more. And they were also trying to acquire the site directly below this, which is a much larger site, much more environmentally contaminated site. And so they have these grand plans to do all this, and they've been working on that for a really long time, and they continue to work on that. We came and started talking to them about saying, hey, you know, you don't necessarily need to wait until you have all these properties acquired. You could actually get going on doing something to get started, and it would kickstart other future development of the area. And so so we ended up working with them to try to put together a plan where we would develop a building similar to what we have at Meriden Commons, sort of similar to Meriden Commons 2, 60 units. Here we did 75% affordable, 25% market rate. We have ground floor retail, and we were able to put the deal together, and we closed, and we're currently in construction. And so you can see here a little bit about some of the resources that the city was able to pull together from EPA. So we really appreciate that to help clean up the site, as well as significant funds from DECD, the Department of Environmental and Community Development. And so without those funds, you know, this project never would have gotten off the ground. And those are really key resources to being making the site clean and available for a developer like us. Next slide, please. So these are some of the costs here. Very similar. This is also going to be a passive house design. Similar sources. We have the 9% credits. We also got Federal Home Loan Bank money here. And on this particular project, we were particularly excited to work both with the local bank, the Torrington Savings Bank, as well as Citibank, and we're able to access two Federal Home Loan Bank grants, both in Boston and New York, which is a little bit unusual and very helpful to the deal. You know, where one of the things we do is we find the money wherever we can to make these deals work, to close these gaps. And we were able to do that here. And so we're pretty excited about that. And if we go to the next slide, you can sort of see where we are in construction. Thank you. So this is where we are now. It's going to be a phenomenally gorgeous site. It's right up against the Naugatuck River. It's really going to extend their downtown. Their downtown is up and to the right. And one of the things that that the city of Torrington is doing here, I mean, they're really investing in themselves as well. The mayor there has got a real vision for what she wants to accomplish. And if you can sort of see directly up to the right, there's that little strip that is basically, it was a road that they closed and they turned into a plaza. And so that was a particularly attracting feature for us wanting to be here is the investments that they made, trying to convert their downtown, trying to make it more walkable, more pedestrian friendly. And we're really trying to pull those people down from the downtown area down to our site. The retail unit will be at the very far end of this building, closest to the downtown. And one of the things we're particularly excited about is we're creating extending the Greenway Trail along the Naugatuck River behind the building, which when it's completed, we'll build it and then we'll turn it back over to the city. And it'll be a public walkway along the Naugatuck River for the residents of Torrington to enjoy and anybody else who comes and visits the area. And that's the end. Oh, sorry, I have these sort of lessons learned. I apologize. Just to wrap up, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that was, you know, the mayor of Torrington is we took a lot of inspiration from her. She really had a vision for this. And that's the phrase that I used earlier that she talks about and investing in ourselves. And that's what they really have done. They've been able to gather the resources that they needed to remediate the site, as well as lots of other resources to renovate their downtown area with the plaza that I mentioned and other locations in their downtown area to really try to enliven it. You know, other lessons learned in how you try to put this together is, you know, the big thing I mentioned is all of this is necessary to really attract a developer like us to execute. We don't have all those resources to bring to it. So there really is the municipal support that's needed. You know, you can't fool yourselves on these, though. It does take a long time. One of the things we did encounter here with the Torrington site is that it did take longer than we had all expected to get the remediation done. They found more contaminated area than they originally thought. But, you know, when everybody was really committed to making it happen, including the EPA, which we went to for additional funds, and DECD, which they went to for additional funds, there really was a way to make it happen. So that's pretty much what I wanted to convey to folks. And I hope I didn't talk too long. I'd like to stop and I'm open to questions.
Thanks, Charlie. That was excellent. Thanks so much. We do have some questions. So the first question is just, what is Passive House?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'm going to get outside my lane pretty quick because I'm not a pass mount expert. But essentially, it's a very highly sustainable building envelope system. It's sort of the next, it's on the next evolution of sort of moving to sustainability. We're actually even getting farther into net zero and other things now. But it's really a way that you do a whole kind of building envelope system. So essentially, it's a single insulation all around the building, an entire shell, so that it really reduces tremendously the energy costs of the building. So it drives them down. It makes it quieter. It's really kind of cutting edge technology for these kinds of developments. And more affordable housing is getting built this way because the cost is coming down. It is expensive to do, but it is coming down, and you're seeing more and more states advocating for this type of passive house construction.
Thank you. Excellent. Next question. Can you talk to us a little bit about the mechanisms that you use to limit liabilities throughout the redevelopment process?
Yeah. So,
and the different types of liabilities that you felt.
Sure.
That you had.
Sure. So part of it is actually having the municipality in there. So, in a lot of ways, there's the municipality takes on some cleaning up the site and then stands behind some of those environmental ongoing liabilities. So there's some ongoing monitoring and things like that. And the municipalities are involved with us as we move forward, both in Merritt and then in Torrington. In Torrington, we actually found it easier in that particular location to actually do a ground lease. Rather than a fee simple, we're open to both, and so by structuring with the city with the ground lease, it helped us protect ourselves from some of the potential environmental liability that we might have going forward. We're not too overly worried about the liability on these because so many people are involved, and we have plans and programs in place to make sure that things are done correctly and that there's ongoing monitoring and ongoing testing. And we do vapor barriers on the ground and, lots of things to make sure that our residents are fully protected. So.
Thank you. Just to stick on the liabilities and risks for a second, you showed that you had a couple loans. And we did have a question about obtaining financing when environmental is a problem. How do you speak to mitigating, or can you speak to mitigating risks that will satisfy lenders?
Yeah, so I mean, it's really interesting. It's we do talk about it as a risk, but if it's really at the end of the day, really a question of the dollars, right? And so, the risks are identified, and everybody has a general, gets to a general place of what needs to be accomplished to get rid of it. And if the resources are there to get rid of it, we can get people comfortable that it's done in a safe and an effective way. So, for better or for worse, there are lots of sites that are contaminated. And so lenders and investors over the years have gotten comfortable. So as long as you have the right professionals working with you, the right consultants, the right folks that are signing off on the results, on the analysis, on the testing, the proper protocols are in place. That's really what lenders and investors at the end of the day are ultimately getting comfortable with, that all those pieces have been put in place. So at the end of the day, it's really a question. We're not scared of environmental issues. It's really a question of the dollars, right? We can all decide what they are. And if the dollars are there to get rid of it, we can all get comfortable that we're going to be okay.
Thank you. One last question. So thank you again for your slides that showed the financials. We did have a question come in about the projection for profit from these projects. I believe I saw like a line on each one for developer fee, but.
Yeah. So in terms of how, when you're doing affordable transactions, because you're leasing to low-income families and the rents are restricted, you're not generating a lot of cash flow out of these properties like you would in a market rate development, right? So market rate developers get their revenue basically through cash flow on ongoing of the project. So in an affordable housing model, it's reversed. There has to be a kind of a capitalized upfront fee for us to be able to cover our expenses and to make a profit, right? The flip side of that, though, also is that fee then becomes, that's our risk, right? So if there are cost overruns or there are issues, The first place that developers and investors are going to go is to our fee. So our fee is doled out over time, over the course of the project, and much of it is held to the very end. So that fee is really at risk. The fees, it's a very transparent process with fees for affordable housing. They're basically set by the various agencies that provide the funds. So there's a set formula for the fees on these transactions, and it's governed by whatever the formula is for the particular agency. So in a lot of states, it's like on a sliding scale. So it's usually set to total cost. So if you, so the first, you know, X amount of costs, you get, you know, 10, you're entitled to a 10% fee, and then it trickles down over time. So it's kind of a sliding scale. And again, those are funds that are there. So it's fixed and set by the agencies, and then it's actually at risk throughout the development process.
Thank you, Charlie. This is great. We're going to move to the next slide. I want to introduce Dave Stebbins. He's going to talk with us about Northland Central. One quick comment I'll make is we did have a couple people type in, ask about where can you find investment package samples? And I will tell you that it is coming. We have been working really hard to pull something together for all of you. So stay tuned and we'll share that as soon as we can. Okay, Dave, take it away.
Thanks, Amy. Good afternoon, everybody. I'd also like to thank the EPA for hosting these webinars and inviting me and Vita Nova to participate in them. I'm a failed retiree right now. I retired full-time from my long-term position with Buffalo Urban Development Corporation last year, and I'm doing some part-time consulting for Vita Nova, among others. And a lot of my specialty in the past has been in brownfield redevelopment. Unfortunately, my co-presenter today, Brandy Merriweather, who is currently the president of Buffalo Urban Development Corporation, was not able to join us today due to a death in her family. So next slide. The case study I'm going to focus on is a redevelopment of an abandoned industrial complex on Northland Avenue in Buffalo, New York. Next slide. So Buffalo Urban Development Corporation, you know, has a long history of redeveloping challenged properties. You know, our role for the state and local government economic development strategies is to kind of serve as the one of the agencies to implement that. And a lot of the way we did that was by acquiring environmentally challenged properties. You know, as I think Elaine said earlier, in markets like Buffalo, the private sector is not ready to take these on. So we stepped in and served as a developer for these. You know, part of that is a risk avoidance for the city of Buffalo and for other government entities, because as a, you know, separate not-for-profit, we can take on those risks and we use other methods to mitigate those risks. You know, a couple of examples of the projects we worked on was the redevelopment of a former pig iron manufacturing facility, Hanna Furnace, on the shores of Lake Erie, into a new business park, Buffalo Lakeside Commerce Park, over 200 plus acres with a lot of nice features in terms of a park in the middle around it, what used to be the freight canal. You can see in the middle of the photo and a dedicated wetlands north of that. Next slide. Another project that we took on was the redevelopment of a former steel manufacturing Republic Steel site in Donner Hannah Coke facility. Similar scenario, our role was to prepare shovel-ready sites for redevelopment. And in this case, of a first major tenant, and it occupies most of the site, is a million square foot Tesla manufacturing facility that occupies that site. But for our new assignment, you can go to the next slide. The state and the city asked us to take on a little bit different role, not just preparing shovel-ready sites for private investment, but to, you know, truly act as a developer for a couple of new projects, new anchor organizations that the state was supporting, finding them a home and developing the property that would be able to house them. The state and the city targeted the east side of Buffalo as a location for this. For those of you who are not familiar with Buffalo, the east side of Buffalo, and it's a big area, but you know, generally it's primarily a minority population, high levels of unemployment, high levels of poverty, And because of that, it's been a target for state and local investments for a number of years. Next slide. The complex that we targeted on the east side of Buffalo was a thriving industrial complex back in its day, probably starting in the 1900s. You can see the railroad line that runs through it, and a lot of the businesses that were located there fed off that railroad line. As part of our activity, we acquired about 35 acres of abandoned industrial property, and a lot of it had been abandoned for over 20 years, but most of them had buildings on them. So, our role again was to kind of recreate this neighborhood and through a number of activities. So the project I'm talking about is just one of those buildings, but our larger redevelopment scenario involves many more other properties in the neighborhood. And if we have time, we'll talk about a little bit more of that. The other thing that should note is that because these properties were originally developed, before cars were prevalent, there is a strong residential neighborhood that butts up to this industrial complex pretty close by. And although it has high poverty and unemployment rates, it still is a strong neighborhood. And so that was an issue that we needed to address as part of our overall strategy. So again, we acquired 35 acres of property. Next slide. Besides the one of the things that, is noted is that, there were a lot of major manufacturing companies that were located in this complex, some that you would recognize, Otis Elevator, Curtis Wright. The area thrived during World War II and shortly thereafter with defense manufacturing. And also because of that legacy, what was left behind were a number of buildings that were eligible for entry on the National Register of Historic Places. And that provided us with some place to start when we started looking at redevelopment issues. Next slide. As starting any project, really one of the key first steps, besides doing the due diligence necessary that Elaine mentioned earlier, and we did some of that before we acquired the property, but then assembling a whole team that can continue that due diligence work. And in our particular case, we assembled a team that had experience in brownfield development, historic preservation, and tax credit. And we got this team on early because in order for us to really explore our options and understand what we could and couldn't do with these properties and how they best would serve the initiatives that the state mentioned, we needed to have them on early, including the contractor. And I think that was really key. Next slide. So within this overall complex, the 35 acres, the larger complex I mentioned, is a smaller complex of which was the Niagara Machine and Tool Works. They manufactured machinery for the sheet metal industry, presses and shears, and the size of this equipment ranged from the size of a small bookcase to the size of a 2 or 3 story house. And you can see when we see photos of the inside, the space they needed. The focus of our property, even though the two buildings in this photo are both owned by Niagara Machine and Tool Works, or were, will be the building on the left. Next slide. So our case study project is redevelopment of this complex, which consisted of a 4-story office building totaling about 40,000 square feet, which you can see in front, and over 200,000 feet of manufacturing space. And as you can see by the roof lines on this photo, they all look different. They were built over 80 years. The initial complex was started in 1910, and the company kept on adding additions to that complex over the years for about 80 years. As I mentioned, it had been vacant for over 20 years when we acquired it. Next slide. And just to give you an idea of the mishmash of interconnected buildings, every box on this diagram was a separate construction. A couple of them actually were built at the same time as the original building up front, but they were then connected over the years. And the other interesting thing, and some of our photos will show that, is that as they kept on building things, and the newer the portion of the complex was, the higher the ceilings got. Next slide. Just some before photos, this is the front elevation along Northland Avenue, which runs in front of it. You can see the 4-story office building in front and a portion of the manufacturing space on the left. Next slide. So this was a traditional daylighted factory building. What was one of the remarkable features of it, which really in the end really created wonderful space was all of the sawtooth monitors and clear stories and skylights. You know, so this was a building, you know, before, you know, good lighting came in place. Again, it was started in the early 1900s. And so there's a lot of day lighting. It saves money. It provides ventilation as well. Next slide. To give you an idea of what the interior looked like, I think when we first walked into this building, just before we acquired it, maybe we got a little nervous. The fumes were terrible. But, you know, the building had almost been untouched since the company closed operations. You can kind of see what it looks like here. And this is an example of some of the skylights as well as another craneway that you can see in the building. Next slide. You know, another interior shot of the building. And what we're looking down is a craneway that extended from the back of the building all the way to the front of the building. You can see down the front. And actually, the window down at the very end of that photo in the middle is actually this view that you're seeing behind me in my background. So just give you an idea of, you know, a little bit of before and after, but it was wide open space that we needed to work with. Next slide. One of the other interesting features of the project was woodblock floors. I don't know how many other people have worked, done redevelopment in older manufacturing buildings, but traditionally in the Buffalo area, companies would put woodblock floors as a basis for all of their equipment and for people working. So the woodblock floors, you know, made it a little bit easier for people, workers standing on their feet 8 to 12 hours a day. They deadened the sound in a cavernous building where noise was really loud. And they also helped absorb oils and greases. Because of the fact that they absorbed oils and greases, we had a huge contamination issue on our hands. And although, you know, the historic preservation officers kind of wanted us to preserve these floors, we knew they couldn't be because of the contamination. Next slide. And cranes, and more cranes. There were cranes throughout this entire building. We counted over 100 cranes. And, you know, we ended up, because, you know, we're turning this into a manufacturing facility still, redeveloping it. So it's not being redeveloped into housing. It's being redeveloped into manufacturing-related uses. You know, we did keep some of the cranes operable, and we kept others for decorative purposes. Next slide. So our overall program was to find, build and renovate a home for two state-sponsored programs, a workforce training center, which would be focused on advanced manufacturing, and they required manufacturing labs where students can work on real manufacturing equipment, and Buffalo Manufacturing Works, which provide outsource R&D for local manufacturing companies, with the predominance of local manufacturing companies being under 250 employees. They can't afford to do their own R&D, so Buffalo Manufacturing Work provides that for them, and they're both part of a larger economic development initiative in the area. But there was also room for some other uses. One of the key ones was some kind of food service and restaurant. We had students in the building. We will have a number of other tenants. We knew that and this was somewhat of a food desert that this complex was located in. We knew we had to provide some food service on site. We wanted to provide a gathering place for the neighborhood and the community, so we provided some public galleries and some additional space for to lease to other small manufacturers and office space as well. Next slide. So besides the environmental due diligence that we did, you know, our next step was to do some preliminary financial analysis. Now, you know, no doubt we were blessed with a lot of state grants to help us with this project, you know, about almost $60 million worth to start that off. But given the estimated cost of this at $100 million, that wasn't enough. So, you know, our charge was to, you know, find out and figure out a way to fill that gap. Next slide. So we looked at three primary types of tax credits to help fill that gap, as well as some local tax incentive programs to help do that. And I'm going to focus this presentation on the first three, federal and state rehabilitation tax credits or historic tax credits, new market tax credits, and brownfield cleanup program tax credits. The first two are federal programs. There's both a state and federal rehabilitation tax credit. New markets is strictly federal. Brownfield, unfortunately, or fortunately for New York State developers that may be in the audience, is only for New York State. Next slide. So just some basics about historic tax credits. Obviously, you know, the tax credit, and as all tax credits are, were designed to encourage certain types of investment by the private sector. In this case, to, you know, preserve and restore our historical legacy. Tax credits reduce a taxpaying entity's liability dollar for dollar. So it's different than a deduction. So it does have real value to investors. And typically what you'll see in this project, especially for larger projects like this, is that tax investors with large tax liabilities, such as banks and insurance companies, are the one that are the ones that are interested in this project. There is basically a market out there for tax credits. So there are organizations that serve as tax credit syndicators. They help connect projects with those investors that are looking for tax credits. Next slide. So just to highlight, some of the differences between these, starting with both the federal and state historic tax credits, they're both valued at 20%. So that means, you know, for a historic preservation project in New York State, you get a total 40% tax credit. The federal program is administered by the National Park Service and the Department of the Interior, and they publish rehabilitation standards that you have to adhere to. The state program is administered by the New York State Historic Preservation Office. Both the federal tax credit, the historic tax credits, typically are taken in 1 year by the investor, although as we'll see, the equity is spread out over longer years. One of the other differences with the state tax credit is that it is capped at $5 million. So that, you know, provides a reduction, I guess, in the amount of tax credit, especially in a project like ours that you would be eligible for. The federal new market tax credits, is intended to encourage investment in low-income communities and to benefit low-income individuals. It's administered by the Department of Treasury, the CDFI division of that, and I forget what CDFI stands for. They award these tax allocations to intermediary entities called community development entities, and it's competitive. So every year that the Treasury opens up a bidding process for tax credits, and these entities, submit their proposals for how much tax credits they get, and sometimes you get them and sometimes you don't. But there is an overall national cap on how many tax credits are available on an annual basis. And you have to find an entity that has an allocation available to them. Whereas the federal and the state historic tax credits, although there's a individual cap per project by the state, there is no national or statewide cap on those. So in a sense, those are almost as of right tax credits that are available to investors and eligible projects. Next slide. So how does the historic tax credits work? As you would expect, you know, it's based on a substantial rehabilitation of a certified historic structure. And there are, you know, some, it has to be an eligible end use. Not all end uses are eligible. There's a three-part process to be eligible for them and to use them. You know, first is applying for, you know, historic certification, National Register certification. The structure has to be either nationally registered listed or a contributing building in a National Register district. The second step is to submit your plans for rehabilitation to first the State Historic Preservation Office, in our case, and then to the National Park Service. They review those and determine whether those plans are consistent or inconsistent with the Department of Interior standards. And typically issues that you see that are troublesome for developers are things like windows. You know, old windows are not very don't perform very well thermally, and there's other issues that sometimes they're old. So, you know, those are some of the things that end up costing a little bit more money sometimes, but also end up being a little bit of a challenge to obtain those. The credits are based on what they call qualified rehabilitation expenditures. So not every cost that you spend on a development project is eligible. As you can imagine, they have to be costs related to the rehabilitation of the structure. Some types of soft costs, your architecture costs are eligible for that. Engineering costs, some of your financing costs are eligible for as part of a QRE as well. Site improvements are not eligible. So just to give you an idea. So as we go through some of the numbers for this project, you're gonna see kind of the basis for these tax credits. That number is gonna change a little bit because depending on the tax credit, what's eligible for that changes. And obviously, you know, the whole point of this is to make the project eligible for some investor to essentially buy those tax credits. Next slide. So simply the way it works is, you know, you have a QRE, a qualified rehabilitation expenditure, you times that by 20%, and that's the face value of the tax credit. But the investors don't buy those at face value, as you can imagine, because there is risk involved in any real estate project. You know, they price those depending on a number of conditions, the national economy, local markets, the experience of the particular developer. And, you know, they can range anywhere from the low 80s, you know, to the high 80s. But, you know, the result of that math, credits times the investor pricing, is your historic tax credit equity. Next slide. The state obviously program is similar. I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on this. I think I'll highlight a couple of things. Obviously, we mentioned the $5 million cap. The state also requires that the project has to be in a qualifying census tract, basically a low-income census tract that's at or below 100% of the state median family income. Next slide. So accessing these tax credits can get a little convoluted from a, you know, legal structure standpoint, but I'm not going to go through all the details here. But essentially, the green box in the middle on the left is the project, you know, the master landlord, that is the project. They typically enter into a master lease with a master tenant, which would be, and all of these will be SPE, special purpose entities that are usually typically created just for the purpose of this project. That's one way to limit liability. So even though BUDC is a, you know, in a sense an SPE, we've created our own SPEs to take advantage of this for this project. And then the federal investor, the tax credit investor, both state and federal, this is just showing federal in this case, you know, but, you know, basically takes ownership of 99% of that master tenant, and then their equity flows through that, and the tax credit, the value of the tax credit, throws back from the master landlord to the master tenant, to the federal HTC investor. Next slide. So to show you the math on how this works for a specific project, we have, in this case, QRE of $90 million, federal tax credit worth 20%. The face value of that tax credit is $18 million. The investor buys 99% of the master tenant, so he gets 99% of that. Therefore, the syndication value is about $17.8 million in our case. The equity pricer, in our case, we got a pretty good one, 91%. So that ended up with a cash value to the project of $16.2 million. Next slide. On the state side, a similar math, $90 million in QREs, 20% you know, tax credit, but again, we're hit with a cap. So the maximum cap is is $5 million. The investor gets 99% of that through the master tenant. The syndication value is 4.9. The pricer on this, because there's a smaller pool of investors that can take advantage of state tax liabilities, was 65%, and that resulted in $3.2 million in historic preservation tax credits for a total of over $19 million in equity for the project. Next slide. They don't all come at once. They don't all come at the beginning of the process. In our case, this tax credit equity was given to us over five installments. In the interest of time, I won't read all of them, but you know, it does bring up you know, some bridge financing and the timing of cash flow issues that you have to be concerned with. Next slide. Again, new market tax credits, you know, they encourage investments in low income communities. The CDFI fund awards it to CDEs. The credit is 39%, and that's spread out over 5 years. That's another big difference between this and the historic tax credit, which you can take in the first year of, you know, being placed in service. In this case, it's spread out over 5 years. So that, you know, kind of decreases the value of that, because there's the time value of money and there's more risk involved because of that. So you see those priced in around the $80, 80 cents per dollar range. Next slide. Only certain, and you can hit the next button because I think it's animated, Abe. So only certain census tracts are eligible for use of new market tax credits. You have to meet the criteria listed above, poverty rate of, you know, over 20% or AMI less than 80%. In our case, we actually hit the severely distressed category. So we had a poverty rate of over 30% and unemployment rate that was 29% at the time we started this project, way above the eligibility thresholds. Next slide. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all the details of this, but essentially the new market tax credits comes to the project in the form of very low interest loans, a leveraged loan and a tax credit entity loan. And they are priced sometimes even below 1%. So they're honestly meant to be, in all appearances, that they're a loan to meet Treasury guidelines and regulations, but they take on the form of equity and they're calculated based on the leveraged loan. Next slide. They come into the project, you know, through another intermediary, through a fund, through the CDE, as you can see in this case, you know, $10 million of qualified equity, you know, is comes to the project in the form of Quilicke A, 6.8, and Quilicke B, 3 million. The tax credit funnels back up to the investor who provides, you know, receives a $3.9 million in tax credits, 39% of 10 million, and in exchange for that, you know, provides 3.2 million in tax credit equity. Next slide. One of the other key features about new market tax credits is they have a longer compliance period and a much more robust compliance requirements. You know, you do have to report on how you are benefiting the low-income community and low-income individuals. So that does take much more work on the part of the recipient of the grant to be able to stay with that for over 7 years, which is the length of the investment. Next slide.
Dave, this is Amy. Just to jump in, we're running low on time. We have a couple of questions, so.
Okay, I will try to run through the rest really quickly. Sorry for taking so long.
Thank you.
So the tax credit allocation, we got two allocations from two different entities, National Trust and Build America, for totaling $14 million. 39% of that had a base value of 5.4. The market pricing was 86%. We ended up with cash for the project of $4.7 million. Next slide. The New York State Brownfield Tax Credit Program encourages private investment in environmentally challenged sites, as you would imagine. Next slide. Eligibility is based on exceedance of certain, you know, soil cleanup objectives. The value of it really is in the second two bullets, the site preparation tax credits and the tangible asset tax credits. Next slide. And I apologize for skipping through some of this. My understanding is that this will be made available to the audience, you know, for some of the detailed information. As I indicated, you know, the two major components are the site prep tax credit. Now, the interesting thing about that is that to be eligible, you have to have soil contamination. But once you're eligible, then you can do environmental asbestos remediation and other hazmat remediation inside the building as an eligible expense. But you can't use those to get into the program. And the real value is the tangible tax credit. And this is provided in the form of refundable tax credit to the liability, to the taxpaying entity, although that takes sometimes 18 to 24 months for that entity to receive it. Next slide. There are a number of different tracks, levels of cleanup, that determines the amount of the site prep tax credit that you get. Site prep is really another word for, you know, cleanup. But things like asphalt parking lot, which goes over a formerly contaminated area, can also be included. That next slide. And the real meat in this is really the tangible property tax credit. Basically, you get a tax credit on the value of your redevelopment or development costs. You have a baseline of 10 to 12% with some add-ons that you can add on to that. There are caps for non-manufacturing projects. It's 35 million or 3 times. For manufacturing projects, it's 45 million or 6 times. Next slide. So for the Northwind project, we had site prep costs of 9.7, 25%. We did a track 4. We got 2.4 million in tax credit. Our tangible property tax credit was based on $94 million in eligible expenses, 20% tax credit with the baseline and the environmental zone, a total of 18.8 million in tangible tax credits for a total of 21.2 million in overall tax credits. Next slide, I'm sorry. So you can see that, you know, there's in terms of the overall capital stack, even though we had a generous level of state grants, $60 million, we were able to achieve about $45.6 million in historic tax credit, or you know, all tax credits combined, which really made the project viable. There are some things to be aware of, those tax credits, but that's why our soft costs are so high, because there's a lot of transaction costs and financing costs are high as well. Next slide. I purposely made this so you can't read it, but I just want to put this up to, you know, let you know that these projects have a very complicated legal structure, you know, to put them together. So, you know, enough said there. Next slide. So we had a very successful, I just want to mention some of the investors. I've mentioned National Trust, Building America. Citibank was the purchaser of both tax credits, historic and new markets, and KeyBank provided the bridge financing. Next slide. Some interesting notes. We had 7 legal teams at closing, and we started the project before we had full National Park Service approval. Next slide. Lots of key partners that I've mentioned already. We can move on to the next slide. Go ahead. There you go. So it's successful. We completed construction. We're 97% leased. It's retained LEED Silver certification, and it's become a center for community activity as well. And I think, Amy, in the interest of time, Abe, you can run through the rest of the slides, but we'll skip those and we'll go to Q&A.
Yeah, thank you so much. What an exciting project. Oh my goodness. Thanks for all these.
It was a fantastic way to end my career.
So. Yeah, congratulations. And I do want to thank you for talking us through the tax credits. Tax credits are very confusing. And I do appreciate you doing that. I think maybe we need to spend more time on that on another webinar.
Someday. Yeah, and Amy, I just want to say that his career is not over. I assure you.
Like I said, I failed at retirement. So thanks to Mike, you know.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Great. Well, yeah, I'm just going to ask one quick question because I do want to have time for our Toledo Solar story. So my question is, just lost it. Hold on a second. So yes, besides the tax credits, were there other tools that you felt that were most successful in helping you promote the property and the reuse opportunities?
Well, I think, and this gets to some of the tenant stuff I was going to talk about, you know, we had, we did a lot of community outreach. So I think anytime you're dealing with a brownfield site that, you know, perhaps has, you know, justice issues, you need to address the neighborhood. So I think that really helped us a lot in terms of meeting with the neighbors right early on, getting them convinced of what was going on and, you know, making them kind of one of our other key partners that I should have listed. So I think that was part of it. You know, the other tools, you know, were a number of, you know, the state is programs, the Brownfield program, you know, is also very helpful in us helping to identify what the contamination was. And the state DEC office, I think, was very, even before we applied for the, you know, Brownfield cleanup program, was helpful to us. So.
Okay, super. Thanks, Dave. Okay, really appreciate that. Let's go on to our last project for today. We're going to talk about Toledo Solar. I'm going to turn it over to Karen Rogalski and Patrick Johnston. And thank you so much for being here. And take it away.
Okay. So, and let's see, you can go to the next slide. So let me introduce myself. I'm Karen Rogalski, and I was the project coordinator in the Cherry Street Legacy Project. I was hired by a Catholic hospital located in Toledo, Ohio, to improve the health of the community. And that was part of the mission of the hospital. And you will hear from Patrick Johnston, who is now the Vice President of Community Investments at the Toledo Community Foundation very shortly. Next slide. Next slide.
I think you're into my slides, Abe. You've got a backup.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not quite sure what happened to my three slides then. So let me tell you about the area. I had an area map, but I'm not sure where it is. And so in 2013, the EPA awarded an area-wide planning grant to the city of Toledo. The purpose of the grant was to help cities take a holistic approach to the challenges that are sort of associated with the brownfield sites. But it was not enough for us to just focus on the brownfield sites. It's important to think about the communities that surround your brownfield sites, because at one point in time, they were thriving and they were the workforce to most brownfield sites. The area that we're going to talk about is actually defined by a major highway, which is I-75 to the north. Cherry Street, where the hospital was located, to the east, and a very important surface street in Toledo. And then Mercy St. Vincent's Hospital was the southern anchor point, and the Overland Industrial Parkway that we're going to talk about is exactly where was to the west. So that was our study area. And this study area was important because it actually connected the downtown core to the northern neighborhood, making it important that revitalization take place so that it would impact everyone. The area around here had four key challenges. Population declined in Toledo by 30%. A third of the population was 18 years of age and younger. The poverty rate was 32% below poverty, and the median income was 15,000. So you can see that we had a very challenging population. Land use, most of the parcels were a quarter of an acre, making it very difficult to consolidate for large scale projects. Zoning, the majority of which was residential, and with the decrease in population, there were lots of vacancies and blight, leading to blight that was going on, and there was a reduction in the demand for housing. So from the beginning, this project had a ton of partnerships coming to the table to continue to work together. And the Toledo Community Foundation was one of those partners that were at the table from the very beginning and continued to be at the table. And Patrick will talk about that shortly. So the area that we're talking about was where the Jeep plant, and Jeeps are known to be made in Toledo, were actually built. And it was cleaned up, but part of the area where the Jeep plant was always located in a floodway. So no building could go on there, which made it even more challenging to the cleanup and redevelopment of this site. But I'm going to let Patrick talk, since his slides came up first.
Thanks, Karen. I appreciate that. And I will talk a lot about partnerships throughout. And Karen, of course, was a big partner on this. That slide that you did have on there, Karen, we both looked a bit younger. So that's something else I will talk about, is that this did take time to develop. And what I'd like to do is tell you the unlikely story of how a community foundation here in Toledo became the owner of a nearly 3-megawatt solar array positioned in a floodway, as Karen mentioned, on a former brownfield site. That array consists of more than 20,000 panels that were produced here in Toledo by First Solar, and it's currently selling energy to a light manufacturing facility run by Dana Incorporated. While it is situated in a former brownfield site, the construction project to build the arrays did not use any government funding. The cleanup of the site did, but the actual solar array did not. So my presentation is going to be a bit different than the other two that you heard today.
And as mentioned in the introduction that Mike gave, the proceeds of the ongoing sales of the energy produced by those panels is supporting charitable activities in the surrounding neighborhoods. So if you are at all familiar with community foundations, you will know that they are not in the property redevelopment business and definitely not in the utility business. Rather, we are place-based public charities that are focused on supporting the nonprofits that strengthen our community. And we do this by stewarding grants from local fundholders. As far as our research has found, and we've done quite a bit, we appear to be the only community foundation in the country that has this type of renewable energy arrangement. So Mike mentioned earlier that it was groundbreaking, and we believe that is the case. So the project I'm going to relate today is a decade-long brownfield remediation and redevelopment strategy that was led by the Toledo-Lucas County Port Authority. And it included a driving priority right from the beginning to incorporate the neighborhoods surrounding the site. Efforts in those neighborhoods, that was led by a newly formed community group with support from Greater Toledo Community Foundation. And in the end, the brownfield remediation and neighborhood revitalization efforts came together into the creation of this solar field that I will talk about. But to arrive at that finished product, it required relationships and it required trust that was built over about a 10-year period. And it also required different types of funding support. While funding from the Ohio Clean Revitalization Fund, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and Ohio's Job Ready Site Program supported the remediation and redevelopment of the 120-acre brownfield. As I mentioned earlier, government funding was not readily available to support the work on the floodplain. Rather, this work was made possible by generous individual donors and businesses in the community who understood the potential of the project to support the surrounding neighborhoods. Abe, you can advance to the next slide. This slide is going to touch on some of the things Karen was referencing when she was speaking. And it shows you the finished product, and it provides a good palette as well to introduce some of the key pieces of this story. So in the foreground of the photo, you can see the South Array with the Ottawa River to its right. And that river does play a significant role in the construction of these arrays, as you'll hear later. If you follow that river up to the top of the picture, you can see the North Array. So there's actually two separate arrays that we own. And the North Array is right where the road starts to bend to the right. So it just kind of looks like a black smudge in this picture. Both of the sites where the arrays now stand, when we started, had remnants of former parking lots where newly built Jeeps, fresh off the line, once waited for shipment to all corners of the country. Now, that large road that runs through the photo is Interstate 75. It passes through Toledo on its way north to Detroit and south to Cincinnati. On the right side of the photo is the new Dana Light Manufacturing Facility. That's the white building with the blue stripe along the top. All the power being generated by both of these arrays is fed directly into that building where Jeep axles are currently being produced. Now, beyond the Dana building, you can see part of the old West End neighborhoods. And those are the neighborhoods that primarily benefit from the energy that's being produced here. And those are also the homes of the residents who've led activities over the past 10 years as the brownfield was being transformed. Last feature I want to point out in this picture is the large smokestack right in the center of the photo. And that is, smokestack is all that remains of the old Jeep assembly plant that used to occupy this entire plot of land. And go to the next slide, please. Give you a little bit of history. Here you can see a historical photo of the property that was taken in 1926. The smokestack is in this image at the top right. As Karen mentioned, Toledo is a blue-collar manufacturing town. Many people know it as the Glass City. It has more than 150 years of glass production by companies like Libby, Owens Corning, Owens Illinois. But probably its most iconic product is the Jeep. The assembly plant that once stood here was at the center of that production for nearly 100 years. As you can see from the bullet points on this slide, it employed tens of thousands of workers. Many of those workers lived in the surrounding neighborhoods. And prior to shutting its door, the assembly plant was the longest continuously operating automotive plant in the country. After moving to a new location in Toledo, where the Jeep is still made today, Chrysler razed the remaining buildings on the former site, leave that old smokestack standing, as you saw in the modern picture. In 2010, the Toledo-Lucas County Port Authority acquired the property. As the Port Authority began the process of rehabilitating the site and preparing it for a new industrial chapter, they were mindful of how the surrounding neighborhoods would be impacted. So key stakeholders like the City of Toledo, various business leaders and nonprofits, including us, the Greater Toledo Community Foundation, were all brought together to coordinate on future planning. You can go to the next slide, please. So before we move any further on this timeline, I did want to pause briefly and explain what a community foundation is and is not. I'm not sure how many of you on the call are deeply familiar with community foundations. But as you can see from this definition that's provided by the Council on Foundations, community foundations are place-based funders that provide vehicles for charitable giving in a defined geographic area. Greater Toledo Community Foundation serves Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan. Individuals, companies, and nonprofits can start funds at the foundation, and we steward those dollars in perpetuity for the benefit of our community. And we do that by making grants to 501c3 organizations. So right now, our foundation has about 900 different funds doing this work. Community foundations occupy this middle ground between philanthropists looking to donate to impactful causes and the nonprofit organizations that deliver the services that meet those goals. So every community foundation you run into across the country is going to be a little bit different to the one next door, because we all take on the characteristics of our specific location and then the characteristics of our particular fund holders. Next slide. Okay, so as far as Toledo Community Foundation, this slide gives a little bit more details. Again, the important thing to note here is that we do not run programs. We do not conduct on-the-ground services. Rather, we provide funding for the nonprofits that do that work. We also assist private foundations and other funders who want to do work in our area by creating and running competitive grant programs for them. Because of this connection to both funders and service providers, community foundations often serve as conveners for larger projects. We're often considered impartial, and we can bring different groups together to collaborate, groups that don't normally work together. So this was the main reason that the foundation was invited early on when folks started talking about the redevelopment of this area. You can push to the next slide, please. So that's a little bit of what Karen talked about earlier. When the time came to begin considering the question of how the surrounding neighborhoods get engaged in this revitalization work, we benefited greatly from technical assistance and funding provided by the EPA and the facilitation services of Vita Nova. There were two big events. One was a Synergy Summit in 2011, brought together a bunch of partners, the city, the county, the Port Authority, Housing and Urban Development, Department of Transportation, faith-based organizations, neighbors, neighborhood leaders, all came together to plan. And then there was a second EPA grant that supported an even more in-depth study that led to the area-wide planning project strategy that was ultimately published in 2015. Now, for the sake of time, Karen did a wonderful job talking about this, so I'm not going to dwell on it for too long. But it is important to note that it really did set the stage for everything that was going to come in the future. And even though our solar array project wasn't even being considered at this time, these sessions brought all the partners together that would eventually come back and make the solar array possible. So in the coming years, when we began to pitch the solar array concept, I can say the doors opened a little bit easier. Because people were familiar because of these planning strategies that they had gone through, and they really knew what the goal of this was. Next slide. So as a result of the Synergy Summit and the area-wide planning project, the community was able to more narrowly define the target population. Residents and neighborhood leaders identified challenges and priority areas to be addressed. A resident-led group, which named itself, as you can see on this slide, the Old West End Neighborhood Initiative, was formed to provide some ongoing grassroots structure and help advance the work. Karen noted some of the statistics when she did the opening, but I'll go over a couple of those again. The poverty rate here was 30%. Unemployment rate stood at about 18%. 30% of the housing units were vacant in this area, and of those that were occupied, about 35% of those were rented. This slide shows the map that Karen was talking about of the target neighborhoods, and you can see the top left arc here is the open area. That's where the old Jeep plant site was. Middle photo shows neighborhood residents gathered in a planning session, and then there's an image on the right where the neighbors created their own newsletter to get the word out about different projects. So coming out of these planning sessions, Greater Toledo Community Foundation took on the role of identifying partnerships. We tapped our own resources to make grants to support projects in the neighborhood, and we connected to other appropriate funding sources to help leverage this work. Next slide, please. That work began immediately, and as I noted earlier, we do not run any programs. We support the nonprofits that do that work, and the new neighborhood association decided not to form a 501c3 themselves, so the foundation helped to find other nonprofits to carry out this work in coordination with the Old West End Association, Old West End Neighborhoods Initiative, I should say. A couple of those organizations, I'd be remiss if I didn't name Center of Hope, Arts Commission of Greater Toledo, NeighborWorks was very involved, the Lucas County Land Bank, Toledo Museum of Art, Funders Network for Smart Growth, Toledo Lucas County Sustainability Commission, Cherry Street Legacy Project through Mercy, and of course our Toledo Lucas County Public Library as well. Next slide. The next couple of slides, I'm just going to really quickly show you some highlights of that work. There was a house painting project that identified a new residence each year to be rehabilitated. Residents also canvassed the neighborhood to identify abandoned structures. And in all, more than 100 blighted homes were identified and demolished. Mentioned some of the organizations involved in this work. Really quickly, though, before moving on, I do want to give credit to the actual people who stepped up, particularly those from the neighborhood who donated their time to help keep this going. The Old West End Neighborhoods Initiative, as I mentioned, carried out this work. So I wanted to recognize Brenda and Ernest Sawyers, Bishop Williams and Neil Blakeman. And from the foundation side, we have two staff members who have been here throughout this entire period and worked very hard on this. So I don't want to get all the credit. I want to give credit to Keith Burwell, our president, as well as Chris Judd, a program officer at the foundation. Next slide. Along with painting houses, we also helped put together two public art murals and revitalize a couple of neighborhood parks. There was a community-wide trash cleanup project that netted the debris you can see in the photo here on the left. Next slide. In partnership with the Funders Network, some green infrastructure installations occurred on vacant lots. As a side note, this partnership did lead to the creation of the Toledo Lucas County Sustainability Commission. And we had a gap in our community without having a sustainability commission. So they were created and they've done all kinds of great work outside of the Old West End in the subsequent years. There was also a Great Lakes Restoration Initiative grant that was secured, led to the planting of an urban tree canopy throughout the neighborhood. Next slide. We had a youth employment project. You can see that in action here. During the summer, those youth mowed over 100 lots each year in the Old West End. There were also some adult employment opportunities because we were looking at the companies that were going to come into this area through the redevelopment. We wanted to make sure the neighbors and residents, if they were interested, would have every advantage possible in applying for those jobs. So we partnered and did some job training programs. So you can see, I wanted to go through this really quick, but I wanted you to see how in these intervening years, there was this plan that was created and then the foundation and all kinds of other partners brought that plan to life through these different projects addressing blight, unemployment, and other issues that were identified by the residents. Next slide. So as all of this work in the neighborhoods was progressing, the Toledo Lucas County Port Authority continued to transform the former Jeep plant site from a brownfield into a modern manufacturing complex they named the Overland Industrial Park. Remediation and redevelopment efforts there totaled nearly $17 million and were supported through multiple state and federal programs. In 2017 and 2018, Dana Incorporated and Detroit Manufacturing began operations at the new site there at Overland. Next slide. So for all those efforts that I described previously, the foundation was honored to receive the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Secretary's Award for Public Philanthropic Partnerships. However, the nagging question remained of how this initiative could be sustained for the long term through a dedicated funding source. The type of impact we hoped to accomplish didn't require years of effort, but it was going to require decades of continuous commitment. This time, the Port Authority continued to consider how best to use the remaining property at the site, and in particular, those two chunks of land adjacent to the river that were not suitable for construction due to possible flooding. So with this as the backdrop, the foundation, Port Authority, First Solar, and GEM began conversations about a potential solar installation. First Solar, for those of you that don't know, is the largest solar module manufacturer in the United States. They were founded in Northwest Ohio. Because of our region's history in glass manufacturing, we've been a leader in domestic solar research and production, and First Solar's largest plant operates here. The company also has a fund at Greater Toledo Community Foundation, through which they've been supporting local nonprofits for years. GEM Energy is the electrical and solar installation arm of Rudolph Libby Group. They're a full-service national contractor headquartered in Toledo. So these initial conversations considered whether solar could be installed on the rooftops of the newly constructed buildings at the site, and whether or not the power generated could be delivered directly to the residents using a community solar strategy. This process is really a good example of the power of getting the right people in the room to come up with a pragmatic plan. Our initial ideas really were not feasible, so it was good to get these experts in the room. Next slide. So here is the plan. In the end, we decided the best path forward was to construct a ground-mounted system. Even though we knew the targeted plots to be designated as floodplain for the Ottawa River, GEM believed they could engineer a fixed solar array there, and the Port Authority agreed to lease the property that was needed for $1 a year to the foundation. First Solar generously agreed to donate panels to the project, more than 20,000 in all. Idea of providing energy directly to the neighborhoods around the site, that quickly became too complicated to navigate. So instead, we looked into connecting the array directly to one of the new businesses on the site. We pitched the idea to Dana. They loved it right from the start, and they agreed to purchase all of the power that was generated by the arrays. So to accept donations on the behalf of the project and to own the array itself, Greater Toledo Community Foundation created the Toledo Neighborhood Solar Supporting Organization. And for those that may not be familiar, a supporting organization is recognized for tax purposes as a separate legal entity with its own governing body that's classified as a public charity as opposed to a private foundation. It must be operated, controlled, and supervised by a parent organization. In our case, of course, that parent organization was the Greater Toledo Community Foundation. So once the arrays started producing revenue, the plan was to form a committee to recommend grants to support local projects. This committee would consist of resident leaders and major donors to the project. And lastly, the foundation and our partners really loved the idea of making the installation itself a learning project, bringing in high school and college students interested in the trades to provide some of the labor. So next slide. Thank you. So like any capital project, this one ran into some unexpected challenges. The identified plots of land, we initially thought them to be floodplain, but they turned out to be floodways. So we had to invest more time and money than we expected into some required hydrology studies to ensure that we met all the applicable codes. In the end, we were approved for construction, but had to scale down the size of the array. Our original plans was to build a 5-megawatt array. We had to scale that down to just under 3. In addition, we were required to raise the panels higher off the ground because it was in a floodway. And that resulted in more steel being needed. And that was, if you recall, a couple years ago at a time when there were new tariffs on steel. So that had already increased the cost for steel. And unfortunately, the racking, which is the majority of what the steel was used for, was one of the areas we were not successful in securing equipment donations. Lastly, the labor costs increased from what we projected, and we contracted with the union labor here to complete the work. They were not able to utilize students due to safety concerns. So I have to say, not using student labor was particularly disappointing, since, as I mentioned earlier, we envisioned this as a paid educational opportunity for young men and women interested in joining the trades, but it wasn't to be. It's important to note that any of these challenges could have derailed the project, now cost more to complete, and would produce less power and revenue than we originally anticipated. However, in this case, the output numbers were not the only motivating factor for the project. Because of those previous years of involvement in the neighborhood work that I described earlier, our partners understood that the ultimate goal here was to benefit community. So many of them stepped up to increase their participation. In particular, the civil engineering firm Manick & Smith was particularly helpful in conducting the hydrology studies. That same group, Manick & Smith, had assisted with the area-wide plan some years earlier and decided to donate much of their labor to the project. Next slide.
Patrick, before we go on, I just wanted to make a brief announcement. I know we're past our scheduled end time of 3 p.m. Eastern. We have a little bit more content and hopefully some time for Q&A to go through. So for those attendees who have a hard stop and cannot continue to stay with us, we do apologize for this overage, but I wanted to let you all know the entire session is going to be recorded. So if you need to leave now, don't worry. You'll be able to replay anything that you might miss. We appreciate everybody's patience. For those of you who are committed and can stay on, please do. Patrick, I'll turn it back to you to carry on with your session.
Thanks, no problem. And I only have a couple of minutes left. I'm heading towards the end right now. So in the end, this project did cost more than $4.5 million to complete. And while it had its challenges, like I mentioned, those collaborations that were created during the planning process really led to its success. First Solar donated all the panels needed to complete the construction. Escawa Selectria Solar, who is an inverter manufacturer, donated the necessary inverters for the project. M Energy donated all of their costs related to planning and site supervision. Electrical engineers JDRM also donated their expertise along with Columbus Equipment and Miller Brothers Construction. Seeing the benefit to the community, more than $2 million were donated by fund holders at the foundation, as well as local philanthropists like the Makalinsky Family Foundation, Medica Health Systems, the Harbaugh Family Fund, Stranahan Supporting and Charitable Funds, the Andersons, and many more. Next slide, please. So the final bit of construction is actually taking place right now. In recognition of the many partners to the project, the foundation wanted to create a destination location at the site. So we collaborated with Toledo School for the Arts, who created a competition at the high school to generate a design that would attract visitors while also recognizing the partners. The winning project was a sculpture garden that's going to feature student creations over the years. And within the next few weeks, more than a dozen or so original sculptures will be on display, and those will be rotated out over the years. Next slide. So the array is now fully functioning and producing power for Dana. Dana and Toledo Community Foundation have a power purchase agreement with payments made monthly, and it's anticipated that the arrays are going to generate power for at least 25 years. So that means we will have annual revenue at approximately $300,000 that we're going to look to get out to those nonprofits working in the surrounding neighborhoods. In addition to the power production, the foundation is also going to be selling renewable energy credits as an additional funding stream, and we're considering battery storage opportunities as well. We expect the proceeds from the sold energy to start going to those nonprofits, like I mentioned, in 2022. And to close, I would like to encourage anyone on this call that is engaged in redevelopment work to consider partnering with a local community foundation to explore what connections they can leverage. Community foundations that I mentioned are great conveners. They have great connections. So there may be capital in places that you wouldn't normally think to look. Put my contact details on the screen. I'd be happy to chat offline if anybody has questions. So thanks again to the EPA, Vita Nova, for inviting us to share today.
Patrick, thank you so much. Karen, thank you so much for walking us through that. That was really exciting. I have a question quickly. Patrick, are other community foundations reaching out to you guys to ask, you know, how did you do this? Can we do something similar?
Yes. Yeah, we are getting questions from a number of foundations, and then just a number of cities around the country. It is something that we believe could be replicable. One thing that I always encourage people to do, though, is to look at the characteristics of their particular region and their place. You know, we were lucky that we had a large solar panel manufacturer right in our backyard, but every community, if you know where to look, you can find partnerships that can assist with this type of project. So yes, we are looking at other locations to replicate this.
Great. Another question that we had came in about just nonprofits, and I don't know if it's somewhat specific to the solar array, but just the site overall. As you're working with all these different nonprofits, were any of them kind of concerned about the brownfield issues, or was there, you know, how did the brownfield issues play into the redevelopment here from the nonprofit side, if they did at all?
Because we weren't doing work on the site, our work was really being done in the neighborhoods. The backdrop of the brownfield site was ensuring that an area that had always been beneficial, so that manufacturing facility that had really benefited the community for so many years, making sure that with the redevelopment, it would continue to benefit the surrounding community and not be developed in a vacuum.
Great. Thank you. And then another question that we had that came in as asking, what was the major hurdle to creating this community solar format versus an on-site business? I don't know if I have that question completely right, but can you talk about that a little bit? Like community solar format, major hurdles for community solar?
Yeah, I can talk about it a little bit, but the other side of that question is really better posed to the Port Authority. They're the ones who redeveloped the site. They actually built the spec buildings to attract manufacturers to the site, and then of course upfitted those for what the tenants needed. So the area that we were dealing with really could not be developed in that way because of where it was situated. So from the beginning, it was understood that something else would have to be done with that area. Our biggest challenges was in the fact that it was situated in a floodway. So this whole project would have been even more economically feasible had it been on just a regular plot of land. So it was good. That's what we had to work with. But it had it been situated somewhere else, the cost would have gone down considerably, making it easier to replicate.
Great.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think it does. It's a great, great way to wrap us up. So those are the main questions. And like Jean said, I know we're over time. But we have a bunch of people who've stuck with us, but I think we can go to wrap up now and give folks their Friday back. So can we go to the next slide? Okay, I did want to say, first of all, thank you very much to our speakers. This was really great. All of our webinars have been great, but it's so excellent to just hear how these projects came together and what it took and the different approaches that you all used. Thank you so much for spending your time with us and talking us through these projects. Thanks to Gene and the whole team for pulling these webinars together. So we are at, this was our last webinar in the EPA Redevelopment Academy series. We had intended to run a workshop at the Brownfields Conference, which was due to happen next month, but has since been postponed. We don't have the new days yet, but we are looking at trying to run a virtual workshop. And the idea would be that we would pull all this information together and have it be an interactive opportunity for you to be thinking about what would you do if you were the owner of contaminated property? How would you attract resources? How would you reduce your risks, liabilities, and attract investment to the property? So we're still working on that. But when we, if we're able to pull that together, we will certainly let you all know. And with that, I don't know if we have any other slides, Abe. Can you go to the last one? Oh, just a giant thank you. Thank you to Vita Nova for pulling all of this information and our speakers together. Thank you to all of you for being part of this. And we really look forward to your feedback. And I look forward to if you have ideas about more things that you want to learn about in terms of how to help get ready and help your community reuse contaminated property, clean up and reuse contaminated property, let us know. And with that, Jean, you can wrap up.
All right. Thanks so much, Amy. Let me go ahead and call up a few quick closing slides here, and we will close out our session today. So the first thing that I'm going to do is just to remind everybody to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network and be sure to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month and will highlight free technical sessions on hazardous waste sites like this as well as others. The other thing I did want to point out to everybody, if I can get my slides to bounce forward, is that we do have copies of the presentation material already available for download. So if you'd like to take a closer look at some of the items that were presented today, you can visit the seminar homepage. It's the same homepage you used when you signed up. It's the same place you went to check in for today's session. And I'll just remind you that there are those tabs along the top of the homepage. For those of you who are watching the recorded version, you can still get to those links by typing in that URL. So this page is active from today forward. I will also point out that for those of you who are looking for CEUs or PDHs, while we don't offer those types of credit hours, I can provide you with a participation certificate. If you fill out the feedback form and make sure you put your email address in there correctly, and then at the bottom of the form, check the box that certifies you were here for the entire live session or replayed the full recording. As soon as you submit the feedback form, you will then have access to a certificate just like this one that you can either save or print out for your own records. If you don't check that box, you won't get one of those certificates. Sometimes the emails wind up in a spam or junk folder, but please know that you can also download it or print it as soon as you submit it. So there's two ways to access the form or the certificate. If you happen to have multiple people joining at your particular location, you can send the link to the feedback form to those parties. They can fill it out on their own, even if they didn't register individually, if they just watched through your connection, and they can still get their own certificate based off of joining you. For those of you who are interested in a recorded version of today's session, it was recorded. You'll automatically get an email from me in about 1 week when that recording is available for on-demand playback. And for those of you who happen to be watching the recorded version right now, you can still access the feedback form. If you look somewhere near the upper right in the online version of the seminar interface, there should be a big feedback form button that you can click on, which will take you to the form, and you can submit feedback based off your replay of our session and still get a certificate. So with that, I want to echo Amy's thanks to all of our presenters, all of our organizers, all of the attendees who joined us over this series of three sessions.